Blog Talk Radio.
So very faithless and perverse generation. What do you say? Faithless and what else? What makes a man get perverted with our faith? What's perverted our Christianity? Faithless.
Well, say that profess that God has given you power, love, and a sound mind, and your mind is not sound. You don't have power to overcome your present situation and circumstances.
Now the devil is always pushing. You can recognize the demons working because they always push to impetuous, immediate action. Don't think, do. And the devil say, if you don't do it now, you'll miss the opportunity. If you don't move now, if you don't sell now, if you don't jump now, it'll be gone.
And the kingdom of God is best expressed by authority and power to cast out devils.
Listen, dear friends, don't forget that little word he said, seek ye first. Come on, that's the secret right there, seek ye first. Seek ye first. Oh, I tell you, the average person said, seek me first. That's it, seek me first. Put me first.
Well, anyone who opposes the kingdom of God and the casting out of devils. Because when we're of God's kingdom, our sole purpose is to destroy Satan's kingdom. Our sole purpose is to cast down Satan's kingdom.
I can tell you whether you won souls or not, whether you get your prayers answered, whether you're happy or not, whether you got a happy home or not, whether you're worth killing in the church or not. I can tell you, if you log your time and let me see how you start your day out, if you grab a cup of coffee and a newspaper and sit there for an hour and let the Bible go begging, brother, you're mixed up in worldliness.
The Word of God said, we're going over to the other side. And in the midst of the Word of God saying, we are going over to the other side, the enemy showed up in the storm. And the first thing that the enemy did was challenge those who walk with Christ. Those who eat with him and slept with him and saw the miracle, the signs and the wonders done by him. The first thing that the enemy did was steal the word that they heard right out of their heart and then allow doubt to rise up on the inside of them. And instead of believing what the word of God said, they said, Lord, we perish.
Reading the word that's going to give you faith, that isn't what he's talking about. It isn't just hearing the word that's going to give you faith. You've got to open your spiritual ear or eye as you hear or read the word and appropriate by faith. Make it yours.
That'll sober you up. That ought to melt your silly heart. I'm not interested in your feelings and your little silly sentimentality. I'm wondering about your love for Christ and compassion for others. Do you care? I'm asking you one question tonight. Do you love Jesus or do you love this stinking world?
But God wants us to be doers of the word and not hearers only. Deceiving ourselves. How many folks are deceived every single week? Going to hear what they call the word and it never once emboldens them or give them a desire or a passion to do the works of Christ.
We want just a bunch of sickly sentimentality, and we want to just fix up sort of a hiding place and a loophole for sinners to say, well, if that old cuss made it in, I can make it in myself.
The kingdom is within you, and the only kingdom that this world is going to understand until the king comes is what they see in us. Because now we are the only creatures that have the ability to walk in darkness and to walk in light.
Oh, God's people, glory!
Hey, shalom, 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 saints of the Most High, Israel. Hope everyone is doing well. Hope this day finds you well and encouraged in the Most High. Of course, this is Elder Becker tonight with this brother segment of Blog Talk Radio. Bless you all for the tens coming in. Appreciate it. You can all hear me well. I hope you really, really, really thoroughly enjoyed the message yesterday. And it, spiritual warfare, is like, you know, the top of the tier topics, that because we're constantly in a fight with Satan all the time. He never stops. He never will. He never quit. He is always trying to divide and conquer Israel. And, you know, so grateful when we get these teachings on, you know, such topics like Jezebel and, you know, the wealth of information that passed provided, even the two letters. All these things are for our edification and learning. We need to remember that. And we need to not let these things slip, because it's when they slip is when we don't put them to mind, and that's when we don't put them to practice, and that's when we get caught off guard. So, well, glory to the King. Well, tonight's topic is a rather strange one. It's not strange, but it's strange to be speaking about it, because it's something so familiar to us, and that we just don't even give any consideration, because it's absolutely totally useless, you know, in the eyes of Israel, because it's such a lie. And we're going to talk a little bit about the pre-tribulation rapture. And the reason that I'm even talking about this tonight, and this is odd, because I always seek the Most High always for whatever it is he would want me to speak to Israel about, to the saints, right? And and you know, I just, you know, sometimes you just don't get an immediate answer. Sometimes it's something else going on, but it was like I'm scrolling through YouTube, and out of nowhere comes up this YouTube video that, it's like, I don't watch this stuff. I never look at it, right? It just showed up on my YouTube feed, and I'm like, okay, so who is this cat, right? What he said? And it's some dude called Dr. Gene Kim, and he's a theologian, Berkeley graduated, PhD. He's got all his titles up there, right? And he's talking about, you know, he's talking about all the absolute evidence of the pre-tribulation rapture. And so I started listening to this guy. I think I got 10 minutes into it, and it's like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, because, like, he uses the hallmark benchmark ones that the pre-trib rapture people use, you know, 1 Corinthians 15, 1 Thessalonians 4. But what he does is he right away, he skips over all the context of what the chapter is saying. He just picks out the one verse and makes a topic. But you understand, people like that, the world just, they get mesmerized with people, letters and law degrees and college degrees. And you read the comments, and they never go back and look at none of this. So the only thing I can figure out is the reason I'm even talking about this tonight is possibly for one reason. It may give the saints, because we know that the benchmarks arguments, right? I mean, they're not even, they're just proper arguments against it. And to those that know the truth, they're very simple, but it's to maybe give you a little bit more different angles about how to attack this lying doctrine should it ever come across your path. And maybe something, somebody will end up listening to this at some point, and it may change their mind is what I hope. Because, I mean, what Yah would have us do, a lot of times we can't even see fully what's going on, and we just be obedient to the Spirit. Oh, thank you, Jesus, for water. So anyway, we're going to get started with that. I got a lot of ground to cover. I might go a little bit quick over some of it. A lot of reading. And, you know, if any of you follow me any amount of time when it comes to these brother segments, is that I try to let the word interpret the word, because that's the best and safest way to do it. Let it speak for itself. And it always speaks volumes, and it always speaks truth. There's no room for innuendo, or no room for private interpretations or anything like that. So, again, we're going to talk about pre-tribulation rapture. We're also going to talk, and there's going to be a lot of talk about tribulation, too, as well. So with that, we're going to get started. So, again, it's going to be a lot going on. Bless you, Brother Josh. Thank you, sir, always for being there, for, you know, showing due diligence and your willingness to, you know, keep the saints posting on what's going through the chat and online and whatever else. So, all right, the pre-tribbers claim that the rapture is not to be counted as the resurrection. that the only the living are taken away. That's at the first, right? The resurrection, the just, is a one-time event, and it is a one-time event. We're gonna talk about that a lot, because the resurrection in and of itself totally dismantles and disproves the pre-tribulation rapture by far and beyond. You can use that one topic and totally destroy the argument. Pre-tribbers claim that because the Bible says that the saints are not appointed to Yah's wrath, that they must be removed prior to the Great Tribulation, which the pre-tribbers assert is all the time in Yah's wrath, which it isn't. And we're going to find out that the wrath of Yah is at the end. Pre-tribbers claim that the Christian church, now Christian church, is removed by Christ prior to the onset of the Great Tribulation, and it is the Yehudim, or the Jews, the people of the book, who must go through the Great Tribulation, and those who endure till the end of the tribulation will then themselves be raptured. So there's, you know, of course, they always claim, yeah, Jesus has to come twice, once before the pre-trib, once before the rapture, excuse me, once, God help me, once before the Great Tribulation, once after, which we know is a bunch of shit and a flat-out lie in and of itself, but they're going to beat down these scriptures, they're going to beat down the verses in Paul's letters and show beyond a shadow of doubt what they believe to be the truth. And it's odd. You know, I know that when you're dealing on subjects like this, when you're dealing with mentality that comes, because all you have to do, like this Gene Kim, right, listen to him, and, you know, the first thing comes to your mind is false teachers, right? All right. And these people are so indoctrinated and so filled with Christian doctrine, a sledgehammer is not going to move them, right? I mean, there's nothing, and that's all they can see, and that's all they believe in, even though it's totally, absolutely contrary, and they've totally twisted and flipped it upside down in his head, either context or the just verse, yet they hold fast to it just because they love the lie. They don't know what else to love, because that's the only truth they've ever been taught is lies, if you understand what I mean. Pre-tribbers severely twist the term caught up. That's where they morph the term rapture from in 1 Thessalonians 4:17 to make it transform into the word rapture. And my bullet points, why not just use the word caught up, right? I mean, that's what it says, at least in the English translation. And for those of you who don't have to know the history of the pre-tribulation rapture, it actually started out with a man named John Darby around the 19th century. And, you know, since the letters have been written, since they've been translated through centuries and centuries, through millennia, as a matter of fact, almost two millennia, this you'll never find this ever spoken about or talked about, but all of a sudden, at the turn of the 19th century, you get some man named John Darby, I believe he's a Protestant, and all of a sudden he gets some revelation truth about what we know today as the pre-tribulation rapture, right? And I've never really studied the history of John Darby, but obviously he was lied to then, and people are still following along with that lie. It's the same old, you know, bait and switch. You know, if you can get somebody hooked on like some new revelation truth that nobody's ever had, and people just flock to it, and they're all entrenched and caught up into it, and then you pass it down from one to another to another. And I know I keep getting off topics, but as this stuff comes to my mind, when I was listening to this Gene Kim thing, listen to the comments, man, these people, nobody in Christianity, that at least in the comments, they have absolutely no mind or no thought to go check context about what things are being presented. They get one scripture that's completely twisted. They receive that as the whole truth, and it's off to the races. So it's easy to deceive a blind man. It truly is. All right. Tribulation is for the saints. It's for those that are Yah's people, his remnant, his elect. It is not for the world. The wrath of Yahweh is for the world, the wicked nations, which is at the end of the tribulation, although there shall come judgments upon men, by the way, the seals and trumpets. That's what these people don't acknowledge, don't understand. These judgments are designed to cause the men of the earth to repent and turn which we know that men will refuse to do just by reading mostly in Revelations, all right? And one thing is key that they never acknowledge the fact that Yahshua himself, Jesus himself, went through one of the greatest agonizing, life-altering tribulations, extreme tribulations that any one human being could ever go through for what he suffered and being, you know, hung on the tree. And yet we got these idiot people that believe that they're completely entitled with absolutely no challenge to their belief, no challenge physically or mentally or spiritually to their belief. They can live life blasé and happy and cheerful and just be standing there and just be whooshed away. And yet the one that they claim is their Savior went through agonizing hell and great tribulation and anguishing tribulation to get into the kingdom. And more so than that. All right, we're going to break this down into several sections, and I'm going to go through them rather quickly because I don't want to drag this out too long, but I got a lot of material here. So we're going to look at this perspective from the resurrection of the dead. Again, you know, we've talked about it before, we've gone all for in the ministry here. Obviously, you know, they call it the secret rapture, but the word says clearly otherwise, that there'll be a sound of a trumpet, and, you know, the whole world's going to know, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn. So obviously it's not going to be secret, but we've talked about them talking points, and these people like Gene Kim and, you know, people that are so bent on trying to prove his theory, you know, have already tried to use certain angles to dismiss these things. So we're going to hit it from different ways, and it's just more arsenal, you know, if you ever find yourself needing it, or maybe it's more proof that when people believe this garbage that they've been deceived, and it may pull them out of the fire. So, all right, we're going to talk about the resurrection from the dead. We're going to start in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 35 through 53. I'm going to read rather quick, so take notes or whatever you have to do, and you can come back and listen to it again. So, all right, starting verse 35. But some men shall say, how are the dead raised, and with what body do they come? So here's the context that Paul is going to explain to the church at Corinth. And because the question was put out there by men saying, how are the dead raised up, and with what body do they come? So the context is we're talking about a resurrection here, right? That's the whole context of 1 Corinthians 15. Thou fool, that which thou sowest is not quickened except it die, and that which thou sowest not that body that shall be, but bare grain. It may chance of wheat or some other grain, but Yah giveth it a body as it had pleased him, and every seed his own body. So Paul is using the simple illustration of the sowing of a seed to get the point across to, quote, these fools are questioning the resurrection of the dead, like such as the Sadducees did, as how this is even possible as the body goes back to the dust of the earth. That's as far as their logic went. Man, it goes back, and that's the end of it, right? There's no more after that. It dissolves, and that's it. But the seed that we see sown into the ground does not resemble what comes up from the earth. That's what Paul is trying to say, as there is a, quote, new body given to the seed, and such as it will be in the resurrection of the just, because that's the whole point of it. You die in corruption, but you come up in incorruption with that new body, as we shall be like unto the angels. And you'll see where this has to go with the pre-tribulation rapture thing again, because they try to use First Corinthians 15 as their benchmark. But yet they totally leave out the whole context of it, meaning talking about the resurrection. All right, verse 39. And all flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one flesh of men, another flesh of beasts, another fishes and of birds. So Paul is trying to break all this down and explain to the differences of these different type of bodies, right? There are also celestial bodies and bodies terrestrial, but the glory of the celestial is one and the glory of the terrestrial is another. There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, another glory of the stars, for one star differeth from one another star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. So he went through all that and explaining all this so he could get to this place to say that. Now, I hope you get the illustration here. So also is the resurrection of the dead. Again, the whole context of 1 Corinthians 15 has nothing to do with being caught up in the air and being caught with the Mosaic. It has to do completely with the resurrection, and the reason is so critical because it only happens one time, and that's at the end. And that's why I'm saying that the resurrection in and of itself and the understanding of it can completely obliterate and destroy a pre-tribulation rapture idea or doctrine or philosophy. All right, so again, so is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power, meaning the transformation that takes place to the body. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. As so it is written, the first man, Adam, was made a living soul, and the last Adam was made a quickening body. Quickening spirit, excuse me. Howbeit that was not first which is spiritual, but that which is natural, and afterward that which is spiritual. The first man is of the earth, earthy. The second man is from Yahweh, from the Master, from heaven. As is the earth, such are they also that are earthy, and as in the heavenly, such are they also that are in the heavenly. Meaning that's where they're at, that's who they are, right? You're the earthy, you're earthy, the heavenly, you're the heaven. As we are born the image of the earthy, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly. But it has to take a transformation. And again, the resurrection is key because this whole chapter is talking about how the change is going to come about to having a glorified, resurrected body. And that has nothing to do with the rapture. This all takes place at the end, the catching up or this pre-tribulation rapture idea. Now this I say, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of Yah, neither does corruption inherit incorruption. So Paul is saying that no way in your form and what you're born with can ever be part of the kingdom of Yah. It's not allowed. It's sin. It's a corrupt thing. It's detestable in the heavenlies and for the Most High. So there has to be a transformation that takes place in order for it to be allowed to get into glory. All right. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. So Paul is going to explain this about the resurrection of those that are dead in Messiah and those that are still living. Okay? And this has nothing to do with being caught up or being raptured up or whatever word they want to use. It has to do with the resurrection, which clearly we'll find out only comes at the end of the Great Tribulation, not before. And so when you take one verse out of here and you make it fit a theology to try to bend it to what you believe the truth is and you deceive all others, well, not only are you in danger of hellfire, but all those that would absolutely follow this bullshit, excuse me. Now this I say, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of Yah, neither does corruption inherit incorruption. But behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. So what is this mystery, right? What is this thing that is not readily known? In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and then these things are going to start to begin. What is the order of these things as the trumpet sounds? And the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. So the pre-tribulation rapture people believe that they are the first one that are entitled to go in before the tribulation. They actually are going to precede the resurrection of the dead. But right here, clearly it tells you who is the first one to get the honors to be caught up to meet him in the air, to meet the Master Yahshua HaMashiach when he comes back. And that is the dead in Messiah. Those that have died in Messiah. And they shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruption, corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. And that's that being all men, whether alive or dead. But the point is that The resurrection is at the dead, and the dead come first before any of the living. So in order for this pre-trib rapture theory BS to work, that would have to mean that at some point the dead would have to rise first, which would come before the tribulation, great tribulation, which would then be out of context and out of line with what the book said. So that in itself always destroys their narrative. Okay, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Like I say, I got a lot of material here, and I am going somewhere with all this stuff, so just keep that in mind. It all has to do with points about how the pre-tribulation rapture absolutely cannot work, even pulling from here and there, because the doctrine is so easily destroyed in so many different facets. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 13 through 18. But I would not have you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning them which are asleep, that you sorrow not, even as others which have no hope. So, right away, Paul, in his letter to the church at Thessalonica, he is talking about, again, those that are asleep or those that are in the grave. Don't be ignorant, right? Behold, I show you a mystery. Don't be ignorant. Concerning them which are asleep. Well, don't be ignorant of what? Don't sorrow for them as others, because there's something going to happen to those that have died in Messiah. For if we believe that Yahshua died and rose again, even so them also which sleep in Yahshua and Jesus will Yah bring with him. Again, so what's the order here? For this we say unto the word, by the word of Yahweh, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of Messiah shall not prevent them which are asleep. You're not going to stop them. You can't, because, in fact, they're going to precede the ones that are still living. For the Master himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, and with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of Yah, and the dead in Messiah shall rise first. There's no denying it. That's what Paul said. That's the clear order. It's the same words he echoed in 1 Corinthians, his letter to Corinth in the 15th chapter. He explains the same thing here again. Just a second witness, Paul knows what he's talking about. And then verse 17, then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Master Yahshua in the air, so shall we ever be with the Most High, with Jesus, right? Wherefore comfort another one with these words. And if you listen to people like this Gene Kim, he doesn't talk about nothing else. He goes right to verse 17, and that's the only one that he quotes in his study, right? And you got all these fools like, yeah, that's it, yeah, that's good, that's the solid I've ever seen. And they have no thought or aptitude to go back and check any of what was written before or after. They take one verse and base their whole doctrine off of one verse and totally exclude the context. Well, again, so if you read then verse 17, then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together. Well, of course that fits a narrative, because if you remove everything else, and that's the only thing that these Christians believe is applicable or all that's needed to actually present them the hard solid facts, then that's going to be deceived. But when you read all of Paul's words, then you're going to find out that that's not the case. You know, how do you skip everything else and go right to that one, but not go to the two verses before that would say clearly the dead are going to be raised first, right? Has nothing to do with the living. It's all about the dead being caught up first. All right, Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 6. Revelation 20, verses 1 through 6. And again, we're talking about how the resurrection in and of itself only occurs at the end of the great tribulation and, of course, of the judgment then. And it will never occur before. It can occur, but it has to occur before those that are alive and remain get caught up. The dead get caught up first, and then those that are alive and remain, but again, it's only at the end, so that in itself completely destroys any possibility of what they call it a pre-tribulation rapture, right? Absolutely destroys it. That's all you have to do when you ever talk to somebody about this doctrine, is just present to them the resurrection, the common sense about it, and show them that These are the order of things, and this is the structure. Okay, Revelation 20, starting at verse 1 through verse 6. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and the green chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. And cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up, and set a seal upon him that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled. After that he must be loosed a little season. So we're reading the context here as John is explaining what he had just been seeing and given in a revelation and an understanding about how the events at the end are to unfold and how to take place. Okay. All right, sorry about that. Okay, verse 5. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. Well, we're going to find out about who the judgment was given to later on, because the book of Daniel talks about that. And that's very important, very key, because it's given to a specific group of people. It's not a divided people. You don't have the Christians here, and you don't have what they call the Jews, who are Israel over here, right? It's not, it's one people, and it's called the Saints of the Most High. But the pre-trib rapulation people have decided to divide it up into different sections to try to satisfy the lie and to cover up their deception the best that they can. It's totally retarded to even listen to. It almost makes you sick. Like I say, I mean, why even talking about this amongst Israel? But obviously, there's a reason for it, and you know, who knows what it's going to, who knows what benefits can be down the road. Okay, and I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Messiah, and for the word of Yah, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his marks upon their forehead. Okay, so, you know, where was the context of this? We only know that these things mentioned, like worship the beast, neither his image, or see the mark upon the forehead, these are all things that took place in the Great Tribulation. That's where we see the manifestation of the beast, his image, and the mark. And or in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Messiah 1,000 years. So these that I saw thrones, and they that sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And then he went on, he said he saw the souls of them were beheaded for the witness of Messiah, and then for the rest of them that had not worshipped the beast, because a lot of this context really focuses in on the very end times when the real war and heat's going to be put to the saints of the Most High. But the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. And this is all taking place after the Great Tribulation, because here we just see in verse 4 that John writes that, and they that I saw thrones, and they that sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them, the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Messiah, and for the word of God, and had which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received the mark of their forehead. These are all absolute evidence. This was what took place after the 42 and a half months or 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation, as you find in Revelation 13. But the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Okay, not to be mistaken as the first resurrection of the dead living again after 1,000 years. But this is speaking of those who had overcome, as we read in verse 4, those who had been either put to death or those who had remained alive. And verse 6, blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of Yah and of his Messiah, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So that's enough about the resurrection. Again, this topic is so vast, you could go on for hours about just the one point about the revelation, but or the resurrection, excuse me, but the point is, and again it is, and what it is that the resurrection in itself completely totally devastates any argument of pre-tribulation rapture. And the evidence here is irrefutable. They can't deny it. It's just by simply reading it in context, which proves their whole theory absolutely, absurdly a lie. All right. We're going to talk about the wrath of Yah now, because that's another thing they're saying, that the reason that Jesus comes back before the Great Tribulation is because he hasn't appointed his people, the church, unto his wrath, right? Yah's people have not been appointed under wrath. So they figure that his wrath is the entirety of the Great Tribulation, which it isn't. And I'm going to show you conclusively that the wrath of Yah comes at the end of the Great Tribulation and not during the Great Tribulation. There's a big difference. Just by showing that and having knowledge about that, again, can help you easily defeat anybody that would want to argue with the pre-tribulation rapture BS. And actually may help pull somebody out of the fire. All right, 1 Thessalonians 5, chapter 1. verses. 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 11. I got a lot of material here, and it's going to be a while, so I hope I don't wear out the patience of the saints. All right. But of the times and seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you. For yourselves know perfectly that the day of Yahweh so cometh as a thief in the night. And there's two different lines of thinking behind these two verses. There's one that says that, you know, basically that Paul said people's thought is there's no need to write unto you, as already know that. Oh my goodness, what is this all about? Oh boy. Hang on, y'all. This don't look good. Sorry. Boy, I hope that's nothing. Okay, so again, verses 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Again, and sorry about that distraction. But of the times and seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you, for yourselves know perfectly that the day of Yahweh so cometh as a thief in the night. And again, there's two different lines of thinking with this. And I don't know, it's not, it could be important, but maybe it's not too important. But, you know, some believe that Paul is saying that there is no need to write unto you as you already know what time and season of the coming Messiah. And the other line of thinking is that there is no need to Paul to even bother to write about the time and season, because there is no certainty of the time frame of the coming of Messiah. And you get these arguments going back and forth about that, because, you know, the Bible says no man know the day nor the hour. And if we pinpoint to a certain time or a season or something, that's saying that we know the day. So there's a lot of argument about this if you look into this and do any type of deep study. But let's get to literally what we're dealing with here, being the, you know, the pre-tribulation rapture stuff. Okay, so 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3. For when they shall see peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. You know, it's not completely clear of whom Paul is speaking about when he says, when they shall save. I mean, who is that? Is that that's saying when they shall save? We do have some indication when we read of the accounts in Jeremiah, where it is written that the false prophets and wicked priests spoke to the people that there is basically nothing to worry about or to fear or be concerned about, as they are heralded and said, peace, peace. You're going to find that in Jeremiah. I forget where it's at, but that's why I just put it here in my notes, because you're going to find the false prophets and did the exact same thing. The priests were saying, you know, peace, peace, peace. And they were trying to persuade the people that everything was fine and good and great. But here comes Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army marching down from the north to totally destroy Jerusalem and the surrounding cities. And you got these false prophets trying to say to the people that, you know, it's all good, it's well, don't be concerned, don't be in fear, because these people are looking up to the priesthood then, and those that say that the prophets and the minister of Yah, trusting in their discernment and their judgment, and that they're actually the spokesman for the Most High, and they're being lied to the whole time, and then they get back in their careless ways, not sober and watching, and here comes the enemy in the gate and totally destroys them. You got the same context here, right? And Paul goes on to say in verse 4, but ye brethren are not in darkness that the day should overtake you as a thief. You are all children of the light and children of the day. We are not of the night nor of the darkness. Remember, this part of the section we're going to talk about the wrath of Yah, because it's important in relationship to destroy the pre-tribulation rapture, because to show that the wrath of Yah is not the pre-tribulation rapture, it's at the end. So there's, in fact, the tribulation is for the saints of the Most High. There's a reason that it's set up like that, to try us and to prepare us and to perfect us to the coming of Messiah. And it's going to be tight together in the 3.5 years. But you, brethren, are not in darkness that the day should overtake you as a thief. But you are children of the light and children of the day, and we are not of the night nor of the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. For they that sleep, sleep in the night, and they that be drunken, drunken in the night. And again, just one of my notes. So anybody that, why would they even read this? If you got this one saved, only saved, I'm going to catch a plane right out of here before the Great Tribulation. What would you bother to even watch for and have to be sober and concerned about? Because you're just going to have to get once saved, always saved, and poof, okay, there, Brother Vernon, Jeremiah 6:14 and 8:15, we talked about peace. The false prophets say peace, peace. Oh, thank you, Brother Vernon. That's it. And so, I mean, what's the point? I mean, why would they even, they could just leave that part of the word out, these pre-trib rapture folks, because there's no sense to watch and be sober for what? I mean, they're just going to walk around, da-di-da-di-da, and then poof, they're gone. Right, and you can see the workings of Satan there as well too, because there's no reason to press, no reason to endure. You just have to believe you're once saved, and you're good to go. You can just continue on life with possible, and you're such a good person that you're not going to suffer the wrath of Yah, which is in the great tribulations. They believe you're just going to be raptured out of here. No sense in watching. Again, totally against the words of Messiah. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet the hope of salvation. For Yah hath not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Master Yeshua HaMashiach, the Messiah. Clearly telling us that the day when Messiah comes as a thief in the night is the time when the wrath of Yah will be performed. And that, of course, is at the end. So Paul makes it very clear that the time when Messiah comes and the thief in the night is when the wrath of Yah will be performed. It's right here, and again, you're going to see that completely echoed and verified in the book of Revelation. It's at the end. The wrath is, it's not during, it's not before, it's at the very end. Who died for us that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. Wherefore, comfort yourself together, edify one another, even as also you do. All right, Revelation 15, verses 1 through 8. I am trying to skip through this rather fast, so I hope I don't lose you all. That's not my intent. I got to grab a bottle of water. Again, so we're talking about the day of the wrath of Yah, and how it in itself, when you understand the truth of it, completely derails this pre-tribulation rapture bullshit. So even in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, we see that reading and careful examination of the text finds that his wrath is actually at the end, because that is the time that Yeshua will present himself. Okay, Revelation chapter 15, like I said, verses 1 through 8. I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of Yah. So now we're going to find out when the wrath of Yah is. So we have Revelation chapter 15, and it appears that some of Revelation is in chronological order, some isn't, some kind of going this way. It's shifting focus from one thing to another, but actually it's all in kind of a real order when you read it like it's put out there, right? So we have John writing, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them, or in these plagues, is filled up the wrath of Yah. So we're going to find out that the wrath of Yah is contained in the vials, or the bowls, as some people call it, right? Which is after the seals and after the trumpets, and then come the vials, which is at the very end, and this is where the wrath of Yah is contained. So it's not during the tribulation. It's actually at the end of the great tribulation. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them. So what's John see when he sees this? He sees the seven angels. He's observing all this. He somehow knows that is in them is filled up the wrath of Yah, in these vials or in these bowls, and that. Then he goes on to say, and I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten victory over the beast. Now, when did this happen? When the things I'm about to read, this happened during the Great Tribulation, because this is the only time where these attributes or these characteristics or these events actually unfolded. So I had them that had gotten victory over the beast, which is Revelation 13, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on a sea of glass, having the harps of Yah. So these clearly are those that had gotten victory, had overcome, that had endured, and there was a lot of tribulation upon the saints during the great, well, we will find out in the coming great tribulation, a great amount of it, right? And so it stands to reason after they've been tried for the 3.5 years, and Satan's been given access to the saints to make war with them and to overcome them, then Yah is even more justified and to be glorified at the end of the great tribulation to pour out his wrath, which is exactly what he's going to do. So you can forget the being escaped from Yah's wrath before and of course the pre-trib rapture, people call it 7-year tribulation, which is a total debunk. That's for a whole other topic. But every place in 4 or 5 different places, it speaks about it being a 3.5-year period, right? And that's when you find out the beast and the image that is created for him that the people are supposed to worship, and his mark, the number's name, is during the specifically labeled for the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation, which is at the end of time. And they're standing on the sea of glass, having the harps of Yah. Again, the key context is they had gotten victory, meaning they had defeated them and endured and found salvation and come to the point where Satan no longer could touch them. They've arrived. When is this time frame? This is those who had gone through the Great Tribulation, as we just talked about. And we can see clearly that these saints are in Shemaim, as the description lets us know that they were standing on a sea of glass. There's a lot written in the description here, which you also find written about in Revelation chapter 4, when John describes the sea of glass before the throne of Yah in heaven. So are these only the souls of men and not those who have been resurrected, and none of the living of this time are counted in among those in verse 2? If we are not appointed to the wrath of Yahweh, which is contained in the vials, then all likelihood we had all been gathered together already by Messiah and are not on the earth during this time of wrath. By further reading, it will become clear that the wrath of Yah comes at the end of the Great Tribulation, is not of the Great Tribulation, if that made sense. And sometimes my notes get a little bit goofy. Okay, Revelation chapter 15, continue on verse 3. Okay, the ones that were on the sea of glass, the one that have obviously clearly had been depicted as has defeated the beast and his mark and his image and his name and his number, And they sing on the Song of Moses and the servant of Yahweh. And this is before that, because we just seen in verse 1 that we have the seven angels with the seven vials which contain the wrath of Yah, but yet we see these people described in verse 2 already in Shemaim standing on a sea of glass, which we know by Revelation 4 is placed right in front of the throne of Yahweh, which is in Shemaim, which is in glory. So that gives you the full context of where this is at. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of Yah, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are their works, O Yahweh Elohim Almighty, just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. So he's the King of saints. The saints, very key, because we're going to talk about the saints. The King of the saints. Not of the Christians, not of the Jews, but of the saints of Israel. Who shall not fear thee, O Yahweh, thy glorify thy name, for thou art only holy, for all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest, or made known, or made clear. And after I looked, and behold, the temple, the tabernacle, the testimony in heaven was open, and I'm kind of skipping through this a little faster to get to this point. And the seven angels came out of the temple. Remember, they had in their hands, these seven angels had the bowls or the vials that contained the wrath of Yah, which comes at the end, not before not during the great tribulation, but at the end, at the very end. So knowing that they come at the end, there's no reason to escape anybody up out of here and claim that it's because they're not subject to Yah's wrath, like it said in 1 Thessalonians 4, that they need to get up out of here before the great tribulation. Well, we find out that the time when the resurrection of the dead and the just at the end will happen when Yahshua comes back just before Yah goes ahead and dispenses the vials. Because we already see in verse 15, or chapter 15, verse 2, that the saints are already in Shemaim. They're already standing on the sea of glass, those that had gotten that victory. Okay, and the seven angels came out of the temple having the seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, having the breasts girded with golden girdles. And one of the four beasts gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials full of what? Full of the wrath of Yah who liveth forever and ever. And the temple was filled with the smoke from the glory of Yah and from his power, and no man was able to enter in the temple till the seven plagues and the seven angels were fulfilled. So again, the wrath of Yah is contained in the vials. It's not manifest during, them are judgments between the seals and the trumpets, them are judgments. They're not the wrath of Yah. The wrath comes at the end. Revelation chapter 16, verse 1, and then we're going to go through 12 and 12 through 16. And do a lot of skipping around here, just trying to put this all together. Chapter 16, verse 1. And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, remember the ones that have the vials that contain the wrath of Yah, what are they going to do with them? They're going to do something with them. Go your ways and pour out the vials of the wrath of Yah upon the earth. So at this time is when the wrath of Yah is going to be poured out and dispensed on the people of the earth. It's going to be completely at this time. Okay, verse 12. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up in the way the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean frogs, like frogs. I saw three unclean spirits, like frogs, come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the false prophet. And again, what is the intent? What is the design of these three unclean spirits? What is their purpose? Verse 14. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles which go forth unto the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to battle of that great day of Yah Almighty. So what do these three spirits do that look like frogs that Paul saw in the design of frogs? They go forth to do what? They work miracles, one, but their key function is that they go forth unto the kings of the earth of the whole entire world, all the whole face of the world, to gather them to battle of that great day of Yahalmael. So we have this great day of battle yet to happen of Yahalmael. It hasn't happened yet. We know by Revelation 15, 1 and 2 that we have those that had gotten victory over the beast, his image, his mark, his name, those that have been living that the beast made war with, are already in Shemayim, so they are going to be preserved from the wrath of the Most High, but not before the Great Tribulation, but at the end. Again, so this is just another way to show anybody that would argue the pre-tribulation rapture theory or doctrine or lie is that this clearly takes place at the end. The wrath is not during any part of the tribulation. It's at the end when the saints have already been removed from the earth. So this obviously reflects totally Paul's words that says we're not appointed unto wrath because we're already out of here, but not before, at the end, because tribulation, again, is for the saints, for Yah's people. That's why we have to remain here for the 3.5 years. So, again, the sixth vial gets poured out, and we got these unclean spirits like frogs. They go out and they work miracles, and their key function is to gather all the kings of the earth and the whole world to the battle of that great day of Yah, which hasn't happened yet. They're going to gather it, but it hasn't happened yet. But it's going to happen because they're gathering for that great day of that battle. Verse 15, behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and see thy shame. And, you know, it's easy to see why John put this in there, because he's trying to get the reader to understand that you don't want to be part of this, right? You don't want to be part of this great day, this battle, because if you find out that when Yahshua comes and you're left, that you're going to be subject to this great day of battle, which is total destruction. You might as well say that your bed is going to be in hell, because after that choice. So again, it's just another admonishment what you need to do and what you better be doing so you don't get caught unawares. That's why they stuck it right in the middle here. Okay, verse 16. And he gathered them together in a place in the Hebrew tongue called Armageddon. What you read in other places is the Valley Megiddo or the Valley Jehoshaphat, is where the, you know, they're going to find out that in Revelation 14, which we're going to touch on, where the blood comes up to the horse's bridle. This is all talking about the battle of the great day of Yahweh. And I know this is kind of like looks like getting off topic, but no, this all is information to even further prove and defeat and what anybody could use or help maybe dispel the notion of those that are caught up in the great, you know, this great false idea and lie and doctrine from hell about the pre-tribulation rapture. Verse 16, and he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. So Revelation 19, we're almost done with this section about the wrath of Yah. Revelation 19, verses 11 through 21. Oh boy. I don't know if I'm going to complete this whole thing tonight because I got a lot more yet. And I know there's a lot being said, a lot of information being supplied, and a lot to chew on. But, I've been looking at stuff for years, so when I read it, it automatically quickens to my mind, my senses about what I'm reading. I can relate back and forth. But I know a lot of times the sisters aren't real familiar with this stuff. They don't really look a whole lot into future events and how things relate to in prophecy. It's usually geared towards the men, it appears, but there's always, everything is learning for our learning. All right, Revelation 19, verse 11, I think I said through 21. All right. And I saw heaven to open, and behold, the white horse, and he that sat upon him was called faithful and true and righteous. He does judge and make war. So we have Revelation 15. Let's break it down again. And after the tribulation, we know it's after the tribulation because there's the saints, those that had gotten victory, are standing on a sea of glass. And then immediately the vials begin to be dispensed. So we can see the order of it. The saints are already safely gathered up in Shemayim. And now we see the vials being dispensed. And the sixth vial is there to get the gather the kings together for this coming event called the Day of the Battle of Yahweh, which hasn't happened yet. But we're going to see the fulfillment of it in chapter 19 as this goes in a good chronological order. Okay, so, and then we're going to see the appearance of Messiah here. And his eyes were a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had no name written that no man knew but he himself. And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name was called the Word of Yah. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. So these armies, and again, there's something very interesting in the context here, and I left it out, but in Isaiah it talks about who the battle axe of the Most High is, or who his battle armor it is, and that's the saints. You can go find it yourself, but it's in there. And so I believe personally these armies that follow with Messiah are the saints that have earned this right to defeat the wicked of the earth. But that's just me. But these are clothed in fine linen, white and clean. You're going to find that these are awarded to those that have overcome and endured to the end. Verse 15. And out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword that with it he should smite the nations and rule them with the rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of Yah Almighty. So again, we're clearly seeing that this is the time of the wrath of Yah Almighty. And there's a winepress that is likened to, the analogy is that they're going to be cast in the winepress, which we'll read in Revelation 14, the vine of the earth, and they're going to suffer the wrath of Yah Almighty. So who are these that are cast into the winepress? Well, we're going to find out that too. It's all in here as the word interprets the word. And he hath on his vesture on his thigh name written, King of Kings and Master of Masters. And I saw an angel standing in the sun and cried with a loud voice, saying to all the fowls that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather yourself together under the supper of our great El, that you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, and the flesh of the mighty men, the flesh of horses, of them that sit on them, the flesh of all men, both free and bond, both small and great. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army. So how did this come to fruition? Because the three unclean spirits, looking like frogs, and the sixth vial in Revelation chapter 16, that went and gathered all the kings of the earth to the valley of Armageddon. Now we're seeing this play out. So we see Yahshua, who we know is the one sitting on the horse with the armies following, coming back through the clouds on his horse, and he's going to defeat this army. Obviously, we know that. But this is all at the end. So again, this in the context, this is all having to do with the wrath of Yah, just proving beyond any shadow of doubt that this all happens at the conclusion of the Great Tribulation. Not during, not before, but at the conclusion. So this in and of itself totally evaporates and destroys this idea that we're not a point on the wrath, so we got to get out of here before the tribulation, the great tribulation, because that's the wrath of Yah. I know it comes at the end when the saints have already been removed from the earth, and then Yah's wrath will be poured out amongst the wicked, if that makes sense. That's the order of it. And again, verse 19, I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army. And the beast was taken, with him the false prophet that wrought miracles, meaning that they were still there at the time before him, with which he had deceived them, had received the mark of the beast and them that worship his image. And these both were cast alive in the lake of fire burning with brimstone. And the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceedeth out of his mouth, and all the fowls filled with their flesh. And I might skip this just to speed things up, because I get so much here all about the wrath. I get so much here. But it's all contained within the Word, and it's just time and time, proof and proof and evidence that it all comes at the end. Okay, so Revelation 14. I'm just going to go Revelation 14, verses 14 through 20, and I'm going to describe it for you. You need to go back and read it. Just open up your word and read it. But you're going to find out in Revelation chapter 14. I'm going to save some time here because otherwise we're going to go way longer than I wanted to. Revelation 14, specifically verses 14 through 20, there's two events described there. Okay? And there's two distinct harvests that are described in these verses here, these six verses. Okay, I'll read through them real quick. I think that's important. Okay, verse 14. And I looked, behold, on a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. So we have the illustration, or what John perceives as the Son of Man, or one like the Son of Man, and most people that I've ever spoken to see this as the Messiah sitting on the cloud, and I tend to agree. But whatever the case, it still doesn't negate the fact whether it is or isn't what's going to happen with these two harvests. So, and so having his head a gold crown, on his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time has come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. Again, this is just proving again that it's at the end of the great tribulation, that showing again that the wrath of Yah is poured out, not during or before. Obviously not before, but not during. It's only at the end. And again, this is just another proof text that this is a fact. So you have this one like to the Son of Man. The angel says, you know, thrust in your sickle and reap. For the time has come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. Okay, now this is the first harvest of the two harvest, or quote, gatherings, to take place. This is important to remember, as we will see. It is very well important. And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, also having a sharp sickle. So we've already had one harvest by the Son of Man, and he's reaped the earth. Now we're going to see something else, another angel, but the detail is going to be a whole lot greater, right? And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came up from the altar, which had power of fire, and cried with a loud cry that him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully wrath. Remember, we just read in Revelation 19 about the great wine press of the wrath of Yah. Well, we're going to see where this takes place in Revelation 14. It's describing that for us. So he said, thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of Yah, which, again, as we already read, is contained, is explained out in Revelation chapter 19, at the end when Messiah comes through the clouds, and at the battle of the great day of Yahweh, when all the armies are gathered together, and they're going to be just likened to the destruction of being cast in this great wine press of raw, and all smashed and reduced, and that's the wine that you illustrate coming out of the wine press would be the same as the blood filling up the valley of Megiddo Armageddon. So that's the metaphor there, the analogy. So, but this, again, this was the wrath of Yah. And the winepress is trodden without the city, and the blood came out of the winepress, even under the horses' bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlong. And again, this was at the end of the Great Tribulation, when the saints had already been removed. And we know that they've already been removed by looking at the events of the Son of Man and his reaping. And then we have the second reaping, which is by the angel. Okay, again, we have read of two distinct harvests, one by the Son of Man, and the reason I'm reading my notes here, because there's something, a few critical things to know here, and the other by an angel which came out from the altar of the temple in heaven. Notice the wording, that the harvest by the angel describes that the vine of the earth shall be gathered, meaning those wicked of the nations. That's who these vine of the earth is. They're attached to the earth, along with the armies of the beast, which are attached to this earth through the analogy of a vine. That's where their lifeblood is coming from, the earth. That they are of the earth, sensual and of the devil. But then we read of the harvest, the gathering of the Son of Man from off the earth, with no mention of the vine in the earth. For those that are Messiah, he is the vine. Okay? And so that's simply when it talks about the first harvest by the Son of Man, it just says the earth was reaped because they've already been attached to the Most High, to the Messiah. But the difference is the second harvest showing them clearly that those are fed through the vine and the earth are attached to the earth, if that makes sense. All right? And again, this is not to be confused with the wheat and tares or the sheep and goats. And as the wheat and tares, we know are, the tares are bundled first, meaning it would kind of look like it's flipped backwards in these two gatherings. But there's more to that when you look at that specific topic about the sheep and the goats and the wheat and the tares. And this in and of itself has to do with the ones Jesus gathers to himself who say they are Israel and are not. So we have the Son of Man. Let me explain this. He comes down and he gathers the harvest of the earth. He reaps the earth. All those that say that they are his, all those that say they are Messiahs, that's the group that is harvested. And then out of that group, we know that that's when Messiah is going to first, out of that group, bundle the tares that are in that group and cast them into everlasting fire and put the wheat in the storehouses. And like the sheep and goats in Matthew 25, he's going to put that group he did in Revelation 14, that first harvest, that he grabs the whole thing, because everybody that does, if they don't name the name of Messiah, you're already in the second harvest, the reaping, automatically. But these are people that say the name of Messiah, and these are the ones that Jesus will say, depart from me, you workers of iniquity, because I never knew you. And so when he reaps all them, then he's going to divide the sheep from the goats. I hope that makes sense. And that goes along with Tubi grinding at the mill, Tubi sleeping in one bed. That's the same context. Oh, my goodness. I don't know if I can continue to even read all this because I just got so much here contained on the wrath of Yah. Okay, if anybody want to make some notes here. Revelation chapter 11, verses 15 through 19. And I'm going to read verse 18 and give you the context, because Revelation chapter 11 has to do with the two witnesses, the two prophets that come, and they do their 3.5-year service. It doesn't say that, but you can pretty much articulate by reading it that that's the length of their service. While the beast is here, they're also here at the same time, standing in steadfast and being the witnesses for the Most High. And of course, this is going to anger the hell out of the beast and the system, because and the Antichrist, because they can't destroy these two witnesses. So whatever they try to do with these two prophets, it's going to be returned right back on them. And just read Revelation chapter 11. And then finally, after their service is done, they're killed. Man. Their bodies hang for 3.5 days. The whole world rejoices, right? Everybody's happy, right? These two prophets in the Most High that torment, we were actually able to defeat them. We feel great. And this isn't getting off track of the pre-tribulation rapture. This, again, is just showing end time events and how that these people have the whole timetable jacked up, and it totally destroys their theory or their doctrine. But, yeah, just the breakdown of 11. And so the prophets are killed. Their bodies hang in the city of Jerusalem for 3.5 days, and they're resurrected. And then in verse 18, this is the statement that says, right? It says that, and the nations were angry, and thy wrath is come. And the reason I put this in there, because it wasn't prior to that. It was only after the death of the two witnesses, which, you know, we're pretty confident took place at the end of 3.5 years, which is the Great Tribulation. And thy wrath is come, meaning it hadn't come before that. Meaning it didn't happen or take place during the Great Tribulation. That was the judgment. and the time of the dead, that they should be judged. It was at this time. They should be picked out. They should be selected, chosen, not meaning that these dead are going to be judged, as in Revelation chapter 20, in the resurrection, the second resurrection after the 1,000 years. And I know it's a lot of stuff. I'm trying to keep this reined in, but you have to look behind the word judged in Revelation 11:18. It actually means that they should be picked out, selected, chosen, as, quote, the sheep and the goats and the wheat and the tares. And thou should give reward unto the servants, the prophets, and to the saints, and then they fear the name small and great, and should destroy them which destroy the earth. So that's another clear example that the wrath is at the end of the Great Tribulation. Again, this is all in case you have to ever talk to anybody about just different viewpoints, that most of these people that talk about the pre-tribulation rapture theory, their doctrine, lying doctrine, don't ever even think to discuss or don't ever take into consideration, because they have a certain narrative, they have a certain, their hallmark scriptures that they use, and they base their whole philosophy on that, their whole doctrine on that. And just by simply using so many different aspects of the books that challenge what their beliefs are, you can easily defeat that doctrine. Maybe help pull somebody out of the fire. Who knows? I don't know. But anyway, so again, that was Revelation 11. If anybody wants to go back and read it later, you're welcome to. I know I have a lot of Revelation 11, 15 through 19, and then Matthew 24, verses 36 through 42, and everybody's familiar with that one. It's talking about, I'm going to read it because it's very important. This has a lot of context and a lot of solid meaning to what happens at the end time, because these are the words of Messiah. He says in verse 36, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Master only, my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." So you have to ask yourself, you have to understand history and the biblical context of the story, the events of how it were in the days of Noah. So what happened in the days of Noah? What was going on, right? What was the mindset of the people back then? This is going to be echoed the same as the days of the coming of the Son of the coming of Jesus, right? Second coming. "For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, and given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And they knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." They didn't know it. They were just going on and on, just doing their business, and none of them knew. This is the same for these Christians, right? They're totally blind to this. They're prescribing themselves a day, but they don't know what to watch for. They have no intent to look for anything, because they believe once saved, always saved. And they're going to continue in their daily affairs. And I know this is written to Israel, but it also reflects in certain false beliefs of other religions, and specifically Christianity, right? "And knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." Okay, here again. "Then two shall be in the field, one shall be taken, the other left." This is not of the world. This has nothing to do with the world. This has to do with Israel, period. This just Israel, the remnant, those that say they are Yah's. Just like we see in the harvest of Revelation 14, we see the separation between the wheat and the tares. We see the separation between the sheep and the goats. That's the same exact thing that Messiah is talking about here. Two shall be in the field, one shall be taken in the harvest, and one left. Taken in the flood means destroy, right? And the other left. "Two men shall be grinding the mill, one shall be taken, the other left. Watch therefore, you know not what hour your Yahweh doth come." They're going to be spared of the flood, and the others are going to be taken in it. And the ones taken are the ones that are going to be destroyed and cast into hell fire. Okay, so now we're going on to the Great Tribulation itself, the thing that the pre-tribulation rapture people totally absolutely deny. Man, time is getting away on me. Wow. I don't even know if I want to try and finish this tonight. I may do a part two, because it just goes on and on and on. I mean, I got so much information. I'm just going to cover a few topics out of here and then just give you something that you can go back and read if you'd like to. Okay, so the Great Tribulation, Daniel chapter 12. What is the Great Tribulation? When is it? What does it consist of? Do the saints, is it committed to the saints? That's the question here. So any one of these aspects I've talked about, the resurrection, the wrath of Yah, when that is, the resurrection, when that is, and now the Great Tribulation, who's that for? I'm just covering all these things, and I'm trying to cover them in detail, as the book says, so you can use them as ammunition if you should ever get into conversation, if you ever care to get into conversation. I know, like I said at the beginning of the broadcast, we're Israel. We just, this stuff is just already totally BS to us, and we look at people like, how can you even possibly believe this kind of crap, right? I mean, you've twisted the scriptures so bad to make it say something that it doesn't. You know the word rapture? I didn't even bother covering that. And a lot of the basic principles of the arguing against the pre-tribulation rapture, but the word rapture comes out of the same etymology, the Latin word that rape does. And so that should tell you what happens to the mind by this theory. Now, again, why do they have to change it to rapture? They had no reason to do that. I mean, at least you want some validity, just leave it to, you know, be caught up. Why not just use the words of Paul as they were translated in the English? You know, the caught up, the great caught up day or something instead of the rapture. Because if you look at the definition of the word rapture, it's some, you know, like ecstasy and all this kind of different, and it totally detracts from what Paul actually talked about anyway. So I listen to this Gene Kim, he's going on, yeah, people don't say that rapture ain't in the Bible. It's in the Bible. I'll show you right where it's in the Bible. So he's trying to define the word, the catching up. If you look behind it, it means to seize by force, right, and taking away. And he said, see, the word rapture is right there, and even though it's not in the definition, he just places it there anyway. So I'm like, damn, all these people are just out there in the open, ain't they? And you got the gullible people listen to them. Yeah, we're going to the zoo, right? Sorry, that's an old Steve Martin thing, but jeez. It's funny, but it ain't funny. So let's talk a little bit about the Great Tribulation and see who actually it's for and who's supposed to go, according to the word, who's involved. And it's for the saints, right? We know it's for the saints. Daniel chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Very simple. Some people may argue it's already happened. Some people say that, you know, it's not going to be all they say it's going to be. But this is what is written in the book of Daniel, chapter 12, verses 1, 2, 3. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation. Even, so it's talking about the nation. Which one? Obviously, it's talking about the people Israel, Yah's people, right? And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, since Yah declared Israel, Jacob changed his name to Israel, even since that time, even to that same time, and at that time thy people shall be delivered. Okay, so it's going to be during this time, a time of trouble that has never been since Yah made Jacob his people and declared them a nation and called them Israel. And at that time they shall be, not before that, not any other time, but it's going to be at a time of trouble such as the world has never seen. Not before it, but at some point in that time of trouble. We obviously know when that is, at the end, before the wrath of Yah is poured out. But the fact of the matter is, all you do is read this and say that, now, if you're a Christian, then this doesn't apply to you. But if you're Israel, this absolutely applies to you, because he said, since there was a nation. He's talking about Israel. Remember, this is a New Testament. This is what the, you know, they call the Old Testament, but that's what it is. At that time, thy people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Well, we read about that in Revelation 20 and 1 Thessalonians 15 in some detail, and 1 Thessalonians 4 in some detail. but the ones we read about in 1 Thessalonians 15 and 1 Corinthians 15, and 1 Thessalonians 4, excuse me, were the resurrection of the righteous. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars of the heaven. Okay, so I'm going to go over quickly something here in Matthew 24 just to dispel this notion too, because like this Gene Kim and other people believe is that there's three parts to the rapture, the tribulation and the rapturing up of different aspects. The Christians, by some reason, for whatever it is, these lawbreakers, they don't observe law. They think it's done away with. They believe they get the first privilege of even, without even getting a scratch or tried, to get caught up out of here before the Great Tribulation, before the Tribulation. It could be the 7 or 3.5, according to them. They say 7, but that's a BS anyway. And then they say that the big tribulation, the Great Tribulation, that's for the Jews. And at that time, the Jews are going to be punished because they left the Most High. And, you know, they're going to be forced back to doing the commandments and everything else. But I'm not making this up. But the Christians never had to do it. But the Jews are going to have to be forced to do this. But, oh, this stuff is just so ridiculous, but people believe this stuff. And it's amazing how you can just twist the scriptures up so badly. But they use a part, this Gene Kim uses this part, that he talks about in order to help substantiate that the Jews go through the Great Tribulation in Matthew chapter 24. I'm just reading because it's so retarded, right? He talks about these few verses, right? Matthew 24:15 through 20. And he says, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso read, let him understand. Then let them be which in be Judea flee into the mountains." So what he's saying is, because this is taking place in Judea, that it's got to be the Jews. It's specifically meant for the Jews because this event is taking place more correctly in Jerusalem, and we're not going to get into all that tonight. But them which be in Judea, when they see this come to happen, then you need to flee. So automatically everybody is labeled a Jew, right? So they got to flee. But he's talking about in context of the abomination, the desolation. When he gets set up, if you have any sense at all, and if you're my people, get the hell out of there because some bad stuff is about ready to come down. So at that time, you get up and hike out of there. It has nothing to do with going through a great tribulation. It's just saving yourself from the wrath that is from basically the Antichrist setting himself up in the city of Jerusalem at this time. And then you go in verse 21, Matthew 24:21, and he says, and then when this happens, when the abomination of desolation, when the people flee from the city, the ones that have enough sense to get the hell out of there because they know what's going on, they've been sober, they've been watching, they've been paying attention, they see the signs of the times, they get up out of there, and then it says at that time, then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. Reflecting completely, absolutely, almost word for word what we just read in Daniel chapter 12, verses 1. A time of trouble since there was a nation up, never been such a time since this time, as it is quoted in Daniel chapter 12, verse 1. So Jesus is saying the same thing as at this time, all reflecting on end time events. And he goes through the rest of the book of Matthew 24, and he's explaining detailed what you're going to find out at this time. Remember, I'm talking about right now in realms of the aspect of the Great Tribulation. So the abomination desolation standeth in the holy place, and then when you're in the city, flee. And, of course, it's at this time, but this is for anybody that has any sense to get the hell up out of there, right? Okay, so, and then Matthew 24:29, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Again, immediately after what tribulation? Of course, the one that Jesus mentioned in verse 21, the great tribulation. So immediately after the tribulation, the great tribulation of those days, this is when these events can happen. And you'll find out that the pre-trib rapture people never talk about the sun being darkened or the moon not giving their light or the stars fall from heaven, right? Of course, now, in their mind, their Jesus is going to come just secretly through the clouds, and none of these events, even though it's not written anywhere like that at all, it's not in the context any place like that. It always describes how Yahshua comes back, but of course they've removed that part of it and skipped that part of it. And but here clearly it tells you the state of the world when Messiah comes back. And then of course verse 30, then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. They shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And then we also know in verse 31 that's at this time that he'll send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. And they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, even from one end of heaven to the other. Again, just going over some quick things about who the Great Tribulation is for. Right? It is for the saints. It's for the perfecting of the saints. Remember, Peter said, in the fiery trial which shall try you. And this is what we're about to see. This is what we're coming into. Okay, Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 17. And this is talking about, and there's a lot of reading here. I just don't want to get too late into this. If you read Revelation chapter 12, it's talking about the woman that is represented. If you read it, know it to be Israel, even though it doesn't say it, but it's obvious by the context. And then there's a war in heaven, and Michael and his angels fight against the dragon, which is Satan. The dragon and his angels fight, and they get their ass whooped, and they get kicked out, right? So there's a series of events that takes place. And what happens there, and I encourage you all to go back and read it. I'm just doing this to save time. So it says in verse 12 that, therefore rejoice, you heavens, and ye that dwell in. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth hath but a short time. Well, what's that short time? Because this is probably indicative of what happens during the Great Tribulation, the 3.5 years. Now, I can't prove it, but that is my own feeling about this because of what's written after that, right? So, and then John goes on to write in verse 13, when the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman which was brought forth the man-child. And the woman, verse 14, was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for time, times, and half a time from the safe face of the servant. So we have the woman, and she's given the ability to escape the persecution of Satan because he's just totally off the chain now because he knows he's got a short time and he can do everything that this signals the end of his. He's just got a little bit of sliver of time left and he's going to come against Yah's people as hard as he can and as badly as he can. And of course, you know, if you're pre-tribulation rapture, you'll never see none of this, but obviously this talks about the people of the Most High. And where are they? First of all, they're going to be hid from the face of dragon. They're going to be nourished times and half a time. That's another study, but it does come out to 3.5 years. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as of a flood after the woman that he might cause her to be carried away in the flood. So we know that she's here. He knows Satan's in pursuit. And what happens? The earth helped the women, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And the dragon was wroth with the woman, because there's a remnant that's being preserved, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of Yah and the testimony of Jesus Christ. So when does this war happen? This war happens in Revelation chapter 13 when the beast makes war with the saints. The language is there. It's clear. So that's how come this is a very good indication that this woman is preserved during the tribulation, 3.5 years, and the saints go through it. That's what the tribulation is for. It's the wrath of Satan, not the wrath of Yah, that takes place during the Great Tribulation. Big difference. And again, it's just another angle to completely annihilate, destroy, and overthrow this BS doctrine. All right, we may cut this short because there is so much here. Just so much. Remember, whoever wants my notes, you just email me, elderbecker777.com at yahoo.com, and I'll mail you my email, my notes. But let me see. Okay, I'm going to skip some of the stuff from Revelation because, again, there's so much. And again, Revelation chapter 7, there's a discussion there. We know at the beginning the 144,000 are numbered. And then we come to the point where there's a situation where they see all these people standing there, right? And there's a discussion between John and the angel. Again, this is just another aspect to prove that the saints go through the tribulation. There's no escaping if that's what it's designed for. Because in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, John talks about that he saw a great multitude, which no man can number, of all nations and kindreds and peoples and tongues, stood before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed in white robes and palms in their hands. And again, this chapter by itself totally destroys. You could just use this one chapter to completely annihilate any theory, any doctrine about this pre-tribulation rapture. Because this tells you who the victory goes to. It talks about, so you skip down to verse 13. And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, what are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? So he sees, you know, as we read in verse 9, he sees this great multitude of so many nations, kindreds, people of tongues stood before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands. So how did they earn these things? How were they do these things? What caused them to actually earn their white robes, get the palms of hand and the right to stand before the throne and before the Lamb which is in heaven? What was the precept? What was the prior events that allowed this to happen? So in verse 13, the question is answered or asked by the elder to John. So, you know, do you know who these are, which are weighed in white robes, and whence came they? And verse 14, and I said unto him, sir, thou knowest. And he said, these are they which came out of great tribulation, and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore are they before the throne of Yah, and serve him day and night in his temple, and he that sit on the throne shall dwell among them. So obviously there's no description of anybody that was taken up prior to a tribulation or great tribulation. These people named, this source is right here, are only those that came out of great tribulation. So this, like I say, this one chapter in itself, you can use it enough to defeat the argument of this pre-tribulation rapture, because clearly if you don't go through it, you're not going to earn to have your robes made white and washed in the blood of the Lamb, because it's going to require something of you. In Acts 14, verse 22, and he said, confirming the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in the faith, that we must through much tribulation enter into the kingdom of Yah. I'm just going to go over some things here quick. John 16, 32 and 33. Behold, the hour cometh, yea, now is, that we shall be scattered, every man in his own, and he shall leave me alone, and yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. These things I spoke unto you, that you might have peace. In the world you shall have tribulation, but be good cheer, I have overcome the world. Jesus said, it's a promise. He told them, you shall have tribulation. There's no escaping it. There's no running away from it. It's there for your perfection. But pre-trib rapture people, help me, Jesus, they want to escape this, and so they're not going to have any ability to overcome anything because there's going to be no tribulation, and they've already committed themselves to hell. 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 12 through 17, Peter clearly talks about, don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. But if you're a pre-tribulation rapturist, then this will never happen to you. This can't apply to you because you won't be here, right? This won't apply. But even though, as Peter words, that this is the thing, that don't let the thing strange to you, and then he goes on to say that you have to be a partaker of Christ's sufferings. Because we're not going to escape that. He had to go through it for us. Who are we just going to scot-free? No. I mean, that's retarded and that's ridiculous. And he goes on to say that, you know, if you're going to be reproached, be happy about it, right? Just like he was, because you're going to be partaker of what he went through. But that's what required. But don't suffer as a murderer, thief, or evildoer, as a busybody of other men's matters, meaning that you're suffering or getting abused or getting trial for all the wrong reasons, right? Yet if any man suffer as a follower of Messiah, not a Christian, but follower of Messiah, let him be not ashamed, but let him glorify Yah. And that, of course, doesn't happen in Christianity because nobody there suffers anything because it's a peace and peace religion. And, of course, the sudden destruction is going to come upon it. But the time has come that, verse 17, judgment must begin at the house of Yah. And if he begins with us, what shall be the end of them? Obey not the gospel of Messiah, gospel of Yah. So, I mean, if you're not around for the judgment, to be a partaker of the judgment, then you've already been judged with the wicked. Again, so that's what I'm saying. I don't have to go through all this. So there's just so much here. And when I was doing the studies, like, my God, I can't, you know, I still got 6 pages here. It's like, man, I just can't keep going on. But there's so much evidence here, right? And then at the end of this, I did Who Are the Saints? And it talks about, I'll just throw it out there quick, Daniel chapter 7, verses 21 through 26. And the key verse is in there, verse 21. And I beheld the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. He made war with the saints. Well, who are the saints? It has to be declared, and it has to be known and made known who the saints are, because it's only one group of people. There is only one group of people that are known as saints. There isn't three different groups. There's not Christians and Jews and Israelites and everybody else. It's just one people, just one group, saints, because they're all following the same. Yah is not divided. He's not the author of confusion. He's one. And I beheld the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. We find the same language in Revelation 13 when he went to make war with the saints, and he was given the ability to overcome them, meaning that Yah took his hedge of protection away from us, and the devil is going to try our faith then during the tribulation. That if you want to escape it, then join the pre-tribulation rapture people and think that you're going to escape it. But what actually is going to happen is you're going to be included amongst the wicked and be destroyed like the wicked. So it's ridiculous to flee the try even assume to want to flee the tribulation. That is your perfecting, and I hope our minds are prepared for it. And verse 22, and until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints and the Most High, the time that the saints possessed the kingdom. Again, so they earned something here. Judgment, they went through it. There was war made against it. They prevailed. Judgment was given to them, and it was time that the saints possessed the kingdom, the one here on earth. And skipping down to verse 25, Daniel 7:25, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and swear out the saints of the Most High to think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until times and dividing the time. That's the same language you find in Revelation 12, with the woman when she's preserved and nourished in the wilderness, time, times, and half a time. Same here with Daniel 7:25. But it's through these times, this 3.5 years, that this little horn is going to seek to wear out the patience of the saints, and then your patience possess your souls. Again, then I talk about Revelation 20, verses 1 through 6, about those are going to be honored to be sitting on the thrones and given judgment. And it's going to be those that have actually found that they were beheaded for the witness of Jesus. I'll specifically read Revelation chapter 20, verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Messiah and for the word of Yah, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither received a mark upon their foreheads, or in their hands, and these are the ones that lived and reigned with Christ a thousand. Well, geez, who are these people that get this honor and get this privilege to actually reign with Messiah for 1,000 years. And they get to sit on thrones, and judgment was given unto them. And who gets to honor? Only the people that go through the tribulation, more specifically the Great Tribulation. That's why the language here is so clear about who it is that gets to earn this right. So if you're caught up out of here prior to this, you're not going to be privileged to actually get through this or show that you're going to endure until the end if you're caught up out of here, if you're a pre-tribulation rapture theorist person. Okay, I got some more, but I'm probably going to pull the plug on this because I knew it was going to get long. In fact, if I read everything I had, we'd be here till been 2.5 hour blog talk, and I don't want to wear out the patience of the saints. So, I sometimes get requests for my study notes, and if anybody ever wants a copy of them, for whatever reason, you can simply email me at elderbrecker777@yahoo.com and I'll get them to you. But anyway, I'm going to stop right there because there is so much and I probably put too much out there already, but I hope what I did put out there, I was able to convey some type of sense. Anyway, that's always my hope. And I understand, like I said, being in the broadcast, and I'll reiterate it again, is that we as Israel perfectly know that this stuff's a bunch of BS, right? But again, like I said, it was laid on me to do this blog talk this way tonight, and so I did for whatever reason. Sometimes I can't understand Yah's reasoning or his ways, but I'm not going to be disobedient to him. So maybe there's just one person someplace that get to hear it and change their mind and be converted to the right way, or you may come across the discussion with the pre-trib rapture person that can hold you to the same arguments all the time that they use because they've already studied the usual arguments, but this obviously gives you a whole lot more firepower to defeat them with. Again, you can simply use the resurrection and prove when it was, or you can simply use Revelation chapter 7, or as we just read at the end, that who is given the judgment, right? And it's those that overcome. So many times it talks about, again and again, the ones that get the honor to live and reign and rule with Messiah are those that went through the tribulation in order to earn that. And it's just something just not simply given because you're in existence and you name the name of Messiah and say once saved, always saved. No, that's going to get you hell. Anyway, hey, bless you all. You have a great week. I'm going to say this before I conclude tonight. You know, if you haven't realized it, that we're in a huge war. The war is real, and there's a lot going on in Israel right now, so you make sure that in this time more than ever, in we call it the dead season, I understand why, but the fact is that for some reason during this time there seems to be a whole lot more in the way of a spiritual warfare happening, and we're starting to see casualties, so keep it tight. And keep prayed up and pray for those that are in leadership because, there's a constant stream of attacks that come on leadership and a seamlessly endless amount of drama. I know we've been put in those positions because Yah knows that we're able. We understand that and accept that, receive that, but it doesn't take away or negate the fact that sometimes it gets pretty heavy. And, you know, in different ways it wears on you. So, you know, pray for them that are in authority. And especially our pastor, Pastor Dowell, as he's been ordained by the Most High to head up this work. And, you know, of course, the other pastors, Pastor Rufus, Pastor Corey, Pastor Muir, you know, all out there doing the work of the Most High, faithful servants to the elders, the deacons, the teachers. And especially for one another, pray for one another that you may escape and you may be healed. But anyway, bless you all. And with that, I'm going to let you all go. All right, much shalom.